morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Peter Haig.
Good morning. Good morning, Ann Haig.
Where is Portugal in the World Cup?
Where is Portugal is through to the, as of today when we're recording this program, they are, I believe, going through to the, looks like they're probably going through to the final round, but I think they still have to play tomorrow.
Well, so, my heart's breaking over poor Italy. That's a bad show.
Yeah, well, what about France?
And France, both of them.
Maybe we don't care so much about France.
Well, no, the defending champions, and there they are.
There they are indeed, and the Azzurri have gone from...
People are going to cry over Italy.
Have gone from rejoicing to total despair, and candidly, their play on the field, they kind of deserved it.
Yeah, well, they're getting older.
Now, of course, both of my teams are still in it.
Right.
So that's pretty exciting,
your teams are the U.S. and the U.K.
Well, just in case anybody's worried about that. But we were talking Portugal because Portugal was just getting ready to be in the middle of World Cup fever when we were there. They had a huge party in the afternoon in one of the parks, which is going to be totally mobbed with people, and that was send off for the team going to South Africa. So
it was an entire park taken over.
Yeah, the citizenry of the city of Lisbon all got together and had a big party just to send the team off. And I guess if they come back successful, they'll have a party when they get back as well. If they slink back like the Azzurri of Italy did, then maybe they won't have a party for them after all. But why are we talking about soccer when we should be talking about food in Lisbon, and the second of two programs today from a recent trip to that very interesting city with a fascinating food scene. And three exponents, each in a different way in this program, of the combination of modern technique and traditional Portuguese ingredients that were mentioned by people who spoke to us in the last program, but the two starting off today's program, Tavares and Manifesto, are definitely on the leading edge of doing this, and it's fascinating to have two such excellent chefs who know one another very well, talking one after the other in the program. First up, Jose Aviles.
He's wonderful. I mean, I think I'm in love with Jose.
And he's only been a chef for 10 years. Less than 2 years ago, took over a very old-fashioned dining room and has modernized it, but at the same time maintained roots, and the room is a wonderful room. And, well, why don't we just listen to the...
Exactly. I can't remember having a better meal than I had at a Lisbon restaurant called Tavares. And we now have the chef on the phone, Jose Aviles. Oh, thank you so much for a wonderful meal, Jose.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, and I'm very happy you liked it. And I hope to see you very soon again.
Yes. Now, tell us a little bit about the restaurant. It's not a new restaurant. It's a landmark restaurant.
Yes, it's a restaurant house, 226 years old. It's the oldest in Portugal, one of the oldest in Europe. I'm not here since the beginning because I'm a little bit younger. I started more or less 3 years ago, a little bit less, 2 years and a half ago. Started in 2008 in January, and the restaurant in the last 30 years before we started now, it was a little bit abandoned, if I can say this, and it was a great and a big challenge to try to bring the restaurant together again and to transform it in a good and a reference restaurant in Lisbon.
Now, I'm going to say just a couple of things here because Luis is going to be way too modest to mention his achievement. He took over in 2008. In 2008, the restaurant, 2009, it was voted the best restaurant in Portugal, or was it just Lisbon?
It was in Portugal.
In Portugal, that's within a year. You since added a Michelin star to the restaurant for the first time, and the best measure of all, I think, of how well a restaurant runs is when the chef's not there, because chef was in Moscow when his sous chef, David, I don't know whether it's Jesus or I would pronounce it Jesus, cooked a wonderful meal for us. I said, there's only one thing you have to be careful of. Jose, somebody's going to come after him and say, I want him to chef my restaurant.
The work is like, it's a teamwork, obviously, and I really believe that we cannot do anything alone. And so I agree with you, and I have to be careful, or else David Jesus will be old for me, still for me. But no, he's very happy here, and we are we make a great team together.
Now, there's another thing that should be mentioned, because the restaurant hasn't always been in the same place for 226 years, but the location, I can't remember the name of the street, but it's in the on one of the main streets in the Barrio Alto, and it's in an absolutely beautiful building, and inside is even more beautiful because it's classically mirrored, a little bit like a dining room in Versailles, but with all kinds of fascinating modern touches as well. So not only are you going to eat great food and drink great wine, you're also going to be sitting in a great environment. But I know Miss Anne always likes to talk to people about how they got to where they are at this point in their careers, how it is that they've been successful, and who's helped them along the way.
I started to cook 10 years ago. I've studied art. I wanted to be an architect. First, I wanted to be a carpenter. But once a cousin, an older cousin, I was like 6 years old and he was 10, and he asked me, what do you want to do when you get older? And I said, I want to be a carpenter. And he said, no, you cannot do that because you're not going to earn money doing that. And he said, you have to be a lawyer or an architect. And I said, a lawyer I don't want to be, so maybe an architect. So I studied till high school. And then after high school, I studied art to become an architect. But then I realized that I wanted to make a different thing, and I went to have a lecture in marketing, communication, and management. In the last year of that lecture, I thought that I wanted to be a cook. And it was like 10 years ago, I went to talk with Maria de Lourdes Modesto, our biggest food writer in Portugal, from Portuguese, traditional Portuguese cuisine. I went to meet her, introduced myself, and I said, I want to be a cook. And she looked at me, and her eyes were shining, and she said, that's a beautiful profession. Maybe you should try to do that. And 2 weeks later, I was making an internship in a very good restaurant in Cascais. They had one Michelin star from a French chef and one Westerman. I started there, and I remember the first day I enter in the cuisine, the kitchen, my heart starts beating faster, and I said, this is it. This is what I want to be.
Wow.
This is what I want to do.
Now
I'm here 10 years later.
Now, you there wasn't a tradition of cooking in your family or anything like that?
No, anything. My mother, I think she doesn't know how to cook, really.
You have something in common with Peter.
Yeah, we did talk to a Japanese chef once, and
yeah.
We said, how come you decided to become a chef? And how did you get interested in cooking? He said, my father was a stay-at-home parent, and he was an absolutely terrible cook.
He had to survive, and for him to manage to eat something good,
most people,
more or less like me. Maybe,
most people say their mother is their inspiration, but in this case, that wasn't true.
You've worked with some interesting people, including Alain Ducasse. I mean, how many people do you talk to who also know Eric Frechon, which we do? Except I knew him. We knew him when he had his own little bistro.
Yeah, we dined with Eric when he had a bistro out in the suburbs of Paris, and then shortly after he was at Le Bristol.
Yeah,
we went there as well. We actually thought he was better the first time, but he's done very well.
And now he's with 3 Michelin stars, and then since last year, and it's perfect.
So he must be doing okay.
I worked then in Portugal with José Bento dos Santos, one of the biggest gourmets of Portugal and a great winemaker from Quinta do Monte de Oro. And he managed to arrange me internship with Eric Frechon and some courses in Alain Ducasse school, and so I started a part of my formation. I don't know. It was with José Santos and Alain Ducasse school, and with Eric Frechon in Hotel Le Bristol. I think the books, I learned a lot from the books, I learned a lot from the people who worked with me, even if they are persons who know less than me, but they know something about their mother cooks, their grandmother cooks, some about the region, cooking regional. So I think every day when I get up and I get out of the bed, I think today I have to learn something. And I'm always with this thing on my mind that every day I need to learn something else and something new. And I have like 500 or 600 cookbooks that I'm always reading and discovering new things. And I had in 2007 the greatest experience of my life in cooking matters, the internship with Ferra Adrià at El Bulli.
Yeah, what was that like? I mean, everybody great seems to have gone through that kitchen, huh?
Yeah, it's great because I don't know I think you need to know how to cook when you go there, because they are not going to teach you how to cook. You need to know how to cook before you enter there, but you can see the passion, the love and fish professionalism that they work there, and you see a creative world completely different from other cuisines, kitchens in the world, and it's crazy. I think the first 2 weeks I was not able to understand what really happened there. But then after 1 month I thought that this is bigger than I was expecting, and this is bigger than I can ever imagine. And I'm getting back there now, because Ferra Adrià invited me to stay one more week before they close.
Oh, you're going back?
I'm going in September for 1 week more. He invited me to go there
one week before they
close.
We were there in 2000, but I don't believe that we'll be able to catch this. Everybody's going to be rushing to get there before he closes.
I think it's impossible. I don't know, because they are really focusing in the last year, and people all over the world are trying to go there this year.
Well, but you know that he keeps changing his plans. So the last I heard, he and his brother were opening a very different concept in Barcelona.
Yes, his brother opened when...
brother was already there, right?
Yeah, but they're going to do a joint new concept together.
Yeah, maybe. They're going to build... after El Bulli, in El Bulli, it's going to born a foundation, El Bulli Foundation.
Well, that's what they said, but it keeps changing.
But anyway, let's slide back to this wonderful food, because there are some traces of the time you spent at El Bulli in one of your dishes, I suspect, the one you call the hen that laid golden eggs.
Yes.
That reminded me of the very first course at El Bulli, which I did not follow directions, and I did not realize that it was a soft-boiled egg, and I bit into it, and it dripped egg yolk all over my only dressy dress that I had packed.
So I've always told her she should do as she's told, but she rarely does that. But
I think all the courses... or some of the courses have inspiration not only at El Bulli, but another master cooks all over the world.
I can see that, I'm sure, but we're going to have you go over some of those in just a few minutes. But would you say, Jose, that you have a style? And if so, how would you define it?
Yes, I think I'm still very young, and I'm starting to have my own style, Portuguese contemporary food, but with inspiration from my experience in the past. But I think in the next years I will have a more defined style, because it's very difficult for you when you are learning and you have like the big chefs that you admired, your professors, your masters. It's very difficult for you to forget them and to make a complete different thing. So
and that's a very,
that,
very well observed and hardly ever explained by people, that, and you've explained it. You're absolutely correct.
Because when you are growing in your profession, you're starting to, it's like when you're growing in life, it's normal. And even your genes are growing, and you are going to a place that it's your place. But in the way you are with another place, another people, and you are, I don't know if my English is so good for me to explain what I'm trying
you're
to do.
You're doing a great job,
yeah,
I must say.
I think you do. I mean, let's just dive into the wonderful menu. And the first item was an absolute total knockout. It's called the cascas. Well, I won't even begin to try to pronounce the Portuguese. But
it's cascais.
No, I won't even, but there's a whole name of the dish, but essentially it's a wonderful assemblage of seafood from Cascasse, which is on the sea anyway, with clams and cockles and prawns and spider crab, all on an absolutely magnificent slate that's dramatic because there's a little mist coming out from below as well. Something that we saw with Quique da Costa at El Poblet in Spain. Then you go on to the golden egg, and then an absolutely delightful dish, which is white veal's feet. So it's milk-fed veal, which results not only in
very, very typical from Portugal, the flavor of the cumin, of the white veal feet, and the chickpeas. I try to make a kind of a journey in the menu, not only for a journey in my mind, but also from the Portuguese land and the sea. And you have near the sea, the Cascais, a beira-mar, how we call the Cascais, the place where I was born. And then you have dishes from Alentejo, from Açores. We are a small country, as you know, but we have a lot of different regions, and they are very, very unique in terms of products and preparations and recipes. So I think my biggest challenge in the next years is to study a lot about all of the regions, and to try to, in the menu, explain the people of these regions, because I think the food explains how we live and how we and where we are.
Yeah, I agree.
For me, the food is that.
Well, there's a sense of place about where you're getting all the ingredients from, and then I guess you're applying all the wonderful techniques that you've learned, and I'm sure you'll continue to learn to make a superb presentation on the plate as well. In fact, it's funny. Do you know Pedro Diaz, that Fesfigura?
Yes.
He told us, he said, Portuguese food was always good, but it used to be just slapped on a plate.
Yeah.
And nobody cared about the appearance, and people are caring more and more about the appearance, and clearly you're doing that more so than I think anyone else that we met during the time we were in Lisbon. Even though it was only a few days, we covered quite a lot of places.
Yeah.
Some places that will render nameless on the air, but no, you and I will know who they are.
Well, I had a question. It had to have been difficult, but how difficult was it to take a landmark restaurant of that vintage and go in as a new chef and modernize the menu?
It was difficult, and still is, because there are many clients from the old Tavares that still alive and come here, and they are used to, 20 years ago, they used to eat this typical French cuisine or some Portuguese food, but mostly French cuisine. But I think the food we try to make here has the Portuguese flavors and have new techniques, and it's, when you see the dish, it's a beautiful dish, but the most important, it's the flavor and give you pleasure. I think, and that's our big goal here, is to do that. So we have people are liking it a lot, and the restaurant, mainly at night for dinner, it's almost always full. At lunch, not so good, because people don't work around here, and they are having lunch in different places. But I think it was because Tavares 5 years ago, 3 years ago, was not so good. People are coming back now, and they are liking what they are seeing now. But I think it was, for me, when I arrived here with only 28 years old, it was very difficult for me to start something complete new from what they had here before.
Well, that's amazing. You have certainly done an amazing feat there, accomplished an amazing feat.
And I'm sure it's just going to keep on getting even more interesting.
I hope so. Yeah.
We did think it was interesting that you're also the founding chef at San Maneras, where we featured the interview with the current chef on our first program on Lisbon.
Yeah.
So you were invited by the owners to go there, and then.
I was the owner of San Maneras in Cascais.
Okay, this is where I moved. Okay, all right.
And then I invited Ljubomir Stanisic, the chef and the owner now, one of the owners now, to work with me, and we opened the restaurant together in 2004. And we stayed together for 1 year and a half, more or less, and then I went to Brazil to work there. and he stayed with the restaurant, and now he transferred his restaurant to Lisbon.
Isn't he a wonderful guy?
Yes, it's a great restaurant, and he's great cook.
And he's so happy, too, about everything. He always has a smile on his face.
Yes.
And his wife is absolutely delightful. I corresponded with, she's a Monica also, your Monica. But it turns out she's his wife and she doesn't really have anything to do with the restaurant at all. But she certainly was a great translator and very helpful in making all the arrangements.
Right.
Just as your Monica did for us, too. So here's the deal, listeners. When you arrive in Lisbon...
Yep.
In the morning, as we did.
Yeah.
And then you start out with a little stroll. You catch the Elevador San Gloria.
Yeah.
You look at the Mirador right next door to get a view of the whole of Lisbon, and then you start walking down the street. You can stop in the San Roque Church, and if there's not a mass going on, you can explore that.
Yeah.
And then you just keep on trotting down the street, and on the right-hand side, going downhill, you'll find Taveras, and they open promptly at 12:30, which is when we got there. And don't plan on doing anything until at least 4:30 in the afternoon, and don't plan on eating anything for the rest of the day. And this will be the most wonderful introduction to the charming and wonderful food city of Lisbon that we so much enjoyed. And so follow in our footsteps and you won't go wrong.
Thank you.
I
am very glad for me and for all cooks. The most important thing is for people like you and come and like what we are doing, and that's our big gift and present every day.
Well, we thought you gave us something extra special, so the food was wonderful, the service is wonderful, the space is delightful.
Yes, and I look forward to seeing you in person, which would be wonderful.
Yeah, I hope so, very soon, very soon.
And thank you so much for getting in touch with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jose.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Bye-bye.
And now we'll take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next, we're going to be talking to, if a chef names his restaurant Manifesto, you might assume he has a few things to say, and we're not disappointed.
And Luis Bahinas certainly had plenty to say, and a really fascinating story about what is behind this very, very dramatically modern-looking space in an old-fashioned part of Lisbon.
Many people think On the Menu is something of a world traveler and we're popping around all over the place, but today's guest is unusual in that he probably bops around the globe more than we do, to the extent that when we were in Lisbon recently, he was in Mexico. He just returned from Mexico. He's on his way to London in just a few days. But welcome, Chef Luis Baena, to On the Menu.
Thank you very much.
Now, what were you doing in Mexico?
Well, I was invited by Patricia Quintana, which is a very well-known chef from Mexico. And what she's doing for the last 2 years, this was the second edition of what they call Torre Aroma de Sabores. And what it means is that what they're trying to show the world through chefs and media and investigators, scientists, you have 100 persons around it. And what they're trying to do is to show the products of Mexico and the simple way of cooking them. And it was very interesting, although a little bit tiring, because an enormous country like you also have in the United States. And the problem with those countries is that when you want to see so many things, it's complicated.
Right.
And you tried to be a tourist as well.
Well, I tried. I tried because, of course, I'm not, it's the Soccer World Cup, and I'm not like a football player, you know, or a soccer player. When I go to somewhere else, I'm not just going there to make a goal and return. No, I want to enjoy. And so when I was in Mexico, of course, I had to visit museums and art galleries, and as much as possible.
Now, I think the French soccer players might have been doing something like you were doing. Because they were sort of out to lunch today. Go ahead, sweetheart.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we haven't mentioned yet, I think that the name of your restaurant in Lisbon tells us a lot about your attitude towards food and cooking and the kitchen. It's called Manifesto. Now, why did you name it Manifesto, Luis?
Well, you know, Manifesto, first of all, it's not really a closed idea. What I mean by that is that I believe everyone can make his own judgment about Manifesto. For me, Manifesto, it means always a statement. And that statement can be the art in the kitchen, can be the culture in the kitchen, can be the kitchen as a sustainability program, can be many things. And I try to do a little bit of each, and that's why in the first 4 months I changed the menu 8 times. So I don't want to be stuck to one idea, to one dish. I want to change. I want to show people that you can have quality, but changes as well.
But one of the things in the manifesto is that you can change the menu anytime you feel like it.
Exactly. Because, as you know, I do a consultancy for a Portuguese hotel chain, which has hotels in Portugal and Brazil, and my work there is only as a consultant. I don't have exactly as much freedom as I have here. So I needed really to make my manifesto so that I can show people. And sometimes, you know, it's even a game of words. And it's an inspiration for me as well. I can read something, I can read a book, and one phrase inspires me. So through that, I can make some, not really silly things, but some provocative kitchen.
Now, I think anybody coming to your restaurant should be prepared, first of all, for some surprises and sort of expect the unexpected. And secondly, a good dose of wit and whimsy and humor in your menu, right?
That's very kind of you, those words. Well, I try to, you know, prefer to see the life as, well, something positive, although you have negative things as well, of course. But having fun doesn't mean to be, how do you say it in English, rigorous? No.
Serious.
To work with technique, with as much honesty as possible, you know. So you can have fun and still make a good job. That's what I try to do, of course. It's teamwork. And unfortunately, I wasn't here to receive you personally. My restaurant was running normally. So being here or not here, it would be the same. But anyway, I think it's rather interesting to see a glass half full than half empty.
Right.
Well, I thought your team did a wonderful job. I mean, the service was so efficient, the service was so smooth. Couldn't have been you prouder of them if we told you how great they were already.
That's very kind.
And I'm sure you were expecting that, otherwise you wouldn't be able to go away.
No, I couldn't otherwise, because, you know, some of the people that work in my kitchen brigade, they've been working with me for some years already. And very interesting, because I was reading a previous magazine from Wine Spectator, the April one, with an interview of Thomas Keller. And Thomas was saying something very interesting from a person that I already worked with, Paul Bocuse. I didn't know that statement of him. So Paul Bocuse was probably the first chef traveling around the world and being well-known. Of course, he couldn't be at the restaurant all the time. So people used to ask him, so chef, and when you're not there, how does it work in the kitchen? You're not working. And he said, well, it's working the same way as when I'm there. And Thomas Keller always uses that statement. That's what I'm going to start doing now.
Yes.
Well, he's talked to us a number of times, and he candidly admits that anymore he's a restaurateur and a businessman. He's not really a chef anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of him says, you know, I feel badly about that, and the other part, probably to do with his bank balance, says he feels much better.
Yes. Now, you know, when I returned from Hong Kong in 1998, I was looking for a project here in Portugal, and I couldn't find it immediately, so I was invited to be a general manager of a company which has quite a few restaurants, some 20 restaurants, and most of them very different one from each other, different concepts, but it was interesting as well. I could learn more about management and all that. But I really felt so that, like we say in Portugal, I was missing the kitchen, I was missing the stove, I was missing all those things. And that's what I really like to do, you know, because creativity is not a thing you can do on your desk and just think and say to the cook, do this, do that. No, you really have to be involved with that.
Well, you have a very innovative approach represented by the manifesto and the menu and the decor, but along the way, I mean, how did you get to this point? From being a little boy who was perhaps influenced to go into cooking because his grandmother was a great cook or something like that, how did you get from there to here?
Yeah, what were your main inspirations and influences?
Well, let me tell you, in my family there is no previous cook. Everybody, well, most of them, they are from the law school, and that's what I was intending to do as well, being a lawyer. But I always liked art very much, and I always used to draw and paint when I was a teenager and play 8 or 10 hours of classical guitar per day. So art was always something that fascinated me. And, you know, cooking is like music. You only have seven notes. Is that how you say it?
Yes.
Do, re, mi, seven notes. And out of those seven notes, you can compose many, many different things. In the kitchen, I believe it's the same. It's a language that should not be static. It should be always evaluating.
Yes.
Yes. And so that challenge for me of creating something in the kitchen, you know, it appeared very spontaneously. I didn't think about it. I began traveling a little bit after the revolution here in Portugal, and it was really a chaos because I wanted to go to the law school. There was no vacancy. I had to go to another school, to another university. And I began traveling. So when I got to Brussels, my first job was in a pastry. And the pastry was a pastry of a good restaurant. So I stood there for a couple of months, 3 or 4 months maybe. And then I changed the kitchen. It was really love at first sight. It's not a cliche. It was really like this.
And from Brussels, where'd you go?
And from Brussels, then I returned to Portugal. Then from Portugal, I went to Brazil. Well, and then I didn't stop really for the past 30 years, because from Brazil I went to Singapore and then Japan and China and, well, a bit all over the world.
There are a number of opportunities on your menu, the different things you can have, including Carbo Corner.
But pardon?
There are a number of different kinds of menus incorporated in your one. There is a Cholesterol Corner.
Yeah.
For your desserts. But we had Stairway to Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So, Colin, explain that.
How far could you go? Just now it's my time of making an interview. How brave were you, or how courageous were you?
We were quite courageous.
Yes?
We're fearless in restaurants.
I don't know if they told you, but the record is for 17 dishes for the moment.
Yeah, I don't remember how.
Yeah, we stopped short. Well, you have the list right there. We stopped short of 17, only because we knew we would be eating in another 2 days.
That's very good. Anyway, Stairway to Heaven was really, well, like music inspiration, and there is an old song called Stairway to Heaven.
Let's
So I stopped. It was a good name for this menu. The menu itself, it really lets me free to not to be attached to one of those fixed menus. So I can do really whatever I want to. I just want to know if people are allergic to something or they don't like a specific thing. And then from there I can play a little, I can travel a little bit around textures, around flavors, around even history if you want. Because what I try to do here, and I believe you could understand that the Portuguese customers are a little bit conservative. So I cannot work here as I work in London or in another city. What I try to do here is work with the products, what we call here the certified products. And Portugal is a very, very small country, although it has it's the second country in Europe with the number of certified products. So starting with the chorizo, going to the ham, passing through the cheese or the vegetables, you have so many things that you can work with, not in the traditional way, and that's my proposition.
Right. Well, some of the items we had included the Algarve clams, stuffing in deep-fried dumplings, pig's trotters, croquettes with coriander and mashed potatoes, codfish, which you have to have in Portugal, panade with spherified olives and coriander, garlic and lemon custard, which again you need to have in Portugal, stuffed black pudding with egg yolk, and green peas guacamole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that one a lot.
Yeah, Peter liked that one a lot. Pizza, tuna fish with vegetables, tempura. It goes on.
Yeah, there's a whole other page.
Yeah, we have asparagus risotto with saffron and lobster and stuffed artichoke.
Well, just, you know, some of those dishes or some of those inspirations that got me to that dish, like, for example, the tempura you were talking about. Tempura is something that the Portuguese brought to Japan because they were the first foreigners to arrive in Japan, and I believe that the Japanese developed it much more, and they have a much better technique than we do in the traditional way in Portugal. But Portuguese cuisine itself is something that, you have a country where we bring some things to other countries, and we bring things from other countries. And my kitchen reflects a little bit of that, perhaps with a little bit more modernity. And it was, a short trip that you made with some of those flavors and some of the things that Portuguese can recognize. That's what I feel. I cannot be very, I don't want to be arrogant, and I don't want to be a star chef thing or thinking that people have to come here and try my food. No, I have to go to what the public really wants, and they want something they can recognize. So that was my major concern in that.
So you're sort of like a culinary equivalent of Vasco da Gama or Bartolomeo Diaz, or who was the other guy, Amerigo Vespucci, to whom we are entirely grateful for discovering the land we live in, otherwise we wouldn't be here.
You know, that sounds like friend words, and friend words always are inflationated, so I do thank you very much, but no, I'm just trying to my job, you know, and I want to, you know, even if you think about the traditional Portuguese food, like you see everywhere in the restaurants all over Portugal, you have bacalhau à Brás, you have so many things that people know, but when you start thinking about it, Mr. Brás was born on the 20th century, so it's not really, well, it's traditional, okay, it has 80 years, something like that, but in the 19th century you didn't eat it. So the kitchen itself, like the language, like the music, it has to keep on moving, it has to keep on advancing. What I think is very important is that you have to have a pattern, and that pattern of taste and the flavor that you can find in the Portuguese cuisine has to be present there. So I don't want to make new dishes just to have fun, just to try to play the creativity chef. No, no. But I think sometimes you have to provoke a thing or a customer, so you can understand that kitchen is, it's not a static discipline. It's it has to change, and the changes you do nowadays in the present, they have to be supported in the past, but thinking about the future as well.
Now, a couple of other chefs that we talked to, in fact, the three or four that we enjoyed the most, all have said the same as you have, that that Portuguese cuisine should remain grounded in the products for which the country is so well known and which it produces so well. But at the same time, something more appealing looking on the plate is also required in this day and age. And there's certainly going to be eye appeal in the food at Manifesto. There's eye appeal in everything that surrounds you at Manifesto. You did that on purpose, I'm sure.
Yes, that was my intention.
You certainly succeeded.
So people look at it from the outside and they don't like it, they won't go in, and that's probably just as well.
Very good, Luis.
You know, it's always a risk when you want to do things in the right way. I have nothing against Michelin stars, but for me it's always a very chauvinistic way of seeing things. Although, my formation, my kitchen backgrounds are in the French cuisine, and I know how to do it because I work with Paul Bocuse. Some colleagues I respect very much, but for me, Michelin doesn't mean really quality. It's a kind of food, it's a kind of kitchen you like to do, and you know how to do it, or you don't, but I believe you can have quality, and you should always have quality, but not thinking about Michelin stars, or those contests like the one you have in UK, like the Restaurant Magazine. That doesn't mean really much to me, because there is a very good restaurant of a friend of mine in São Paulo. It's called Dome, D-O-M, by Alexa Tower. And I know a very good restaurant in Tokyo by Misa Tsuji. It's a chef. So many different restaurants that don't fit in the cliche of Michelin cuisine. So I think sometimes you have to break the rules so that people might understand that you can have quality, even playing or in a provocative way, and they can get happy by the end. That's what I like more. What I think also is that in the kitchen, liking the music as well, going back to the always to that example of music, because for me it's very important. I can go now in my car and listen to some Patentini or to Johann Sebastian Bach, you know, different styles. But if I go to a concert and I listen to that concert, and maybe you have some show lights or you don't, you are dressing one way or any other way, but that touches your feelings. It's not only leaving a message. When you want to only the sensorial part of the kitchen and go to an emotional part of the kitchen, those moments that I try to do here, I think they're, well, it's a way of letting people remember that experience for a longer period.
Well, this is, listeners, this is a restaurant adventure. This is a dining adventure. It's a sensory adventure. It's in a slightly out-of-the-way part of the city of Lisbon, which I think Julie said is now developing as a design district, but was previously perhaps a little unloved as a part of town. But it makes a wonderful statement, and I have a great picture. It's one of these days I'll get up on the website, which reflects a modernist building across the square in the windows of Manifesto. Seemed like a very appropriate thing to do, and I hope my photograph of it was successful. I'm sure you know the one I'm thinking of. I took a photograph of your front windows with the reflection of the nice modernist building which is across the square. And I'm hoping I got the angle right, because it seems just like an appropriate statement for a restaurant in a design district. It's a design adventure in and of itself before you even get to the food. And when you get to the food, you'll find the same elements belong. So, Luis, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. We wish you success on your next trip, which is to my native land, I understand.
Yes, it is.
I'm sure you'll have a great time there as well.
I do thank you very much, and as I told you, I'm very sorry not being here to receive you, but thank you very much for coming, and I hope you enjoy it.
We do, and we'll be back.
Listeners.
Yeah, well, our paths will cross, I am sure of that, and next time we're coming to Portugal, we'll be sure to be in touch and get your suggestions as to where we ought to experience that we haven't so far.
Correct, fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Luis.
Thank you very much, and hoping to hear from you soon.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Ciao. Well, Mel, stay with us while we take another short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and, well, you know, Rabbit, I think you should handle this next one.
You think I should handle this one? Okay,
yes.
Well, if Luis Baena is a serial restaurant opener and consultant, Olivier and his sister Natalie have been opening restaurants a lot at a time as well. And Olivier is unusual in that it seems to be one of the best-known restaurants in the United States. In Lisbon. It seems perhaps a little less well-known in Lisbon, and it has some very interesting concepts behind the approach to putting a meal on the table.
Yeah, the hospitality concepts are
that I think you'll find very interesting. One of the things we did discover is that most likely thing that will happen to Olivier is the people at the next table will be Americans. And that may or may not be something you want. If it's something you want,
they've gotten a lot of
rush
press
here, but
in,
this is a,
in the U.S.
This is a place with a strong reputation, and you can gauge for yourselves after you listen to host and sister of Chef Olivier, Natalie.
I'm going to say your name, Natalie, your last name, Koshka.
Costa.
Costa.
C-O-A-S-T. T-A.
Am I totally hopeless at learning Portuguese? I don't know. But anyhow, it's a pleasure to meet you and to have you explain your family's restaurant business for On the Menu. You were just talking to us a little bit about the history. Can you explain to our listeners how you started with this, back to when your father was...
Exactly, okay. So as I was saying, my father is called Michel and all the Portuguese people know him. He's one of the most known chef in Portugal. He was the first cook having program, television program in Portugal.
Wow.
So he's, at the time in 1980s, he was most known, more known than the president of the republic here. So because everybody know him. And my brother and me, we follow his steps. So Olivier started working.
And Olivier is your
Olivier,
brother.
My brother.
So who's also a chef.
My brother and my boss.
That must be tough.
No, that's...
I'm not sure that's... I sneak something in here. I bet that's not entirely true.
No, it's difficult sometimes because we are family and, of course, we fight it more than... boss and waiter, but he totally trusts me, and he know that he can't do alone, so we are two working in all of this, and we have now three restaurants. We are going to open more two restaurants this year, so...
Two more.
So we we opened a Japanese 15 days ago, and now we're going to
Japanese
open a tapas.
Restaurant.
Yes.
And now a tapas,
and then a burger and pizza deluxe.
And then
so
are you
that's
done?
A new project, and I'm done. No, I don't want to do any more restaurants. It's too much, because we can't leave other people do our work, and we like to be always seeing and being careful, taking care of the clients. So it's always difficult when you can't be 100% of your time in the restaurant.
Now, we are in the cafe, which is only 5 years old.
Exactly.
And
cafe now, it doesn't call cafe. Now we call it Olivier Restaurant. So the cafe, okay, 2 years ago, transformed in Olivier Restaurant because we moved from the Bairro Alto, the old Olivier Restaurant, and then we put this one, Olivier Restaurant, in Olivier Cafe. So now it's called Olivier Restaurant.
Yeah, and before we sign off, we must make sure that we get the current restaurants and the new ones that are coming,
yes,
because there is information out there.
Yeah.
People have written articles about Olivier Restaurant over the years, and some of those locations are wrong.
Yes, that's
some
a
of
big
the information
problem.
Is wrong. So we must make sure that we get that up to date. So we'll do that before we start.
Is your website up to date?
My website is always up to date.
But then why don't we give everybody the website number so they could check.
Of course.
Okay, it's www.restaurante-olivier, as in Sir Lawrence, olivier.com, right?
Exactly.
And so all the new developments will be listed on
yes,
the website.
On the website, because all the guides still have the old address, so people get to the wrong address. But anyway,
as
if you want to come
did,
here,
yeah,
I always recommend to do reservation. And normally we can understand where people are calling because we stay with the old phone. So we can understand if people are calling to the old address, and we always say to the clients to be careful about the new address. But all the guides still... If we are waiting them to get the new edition, so then we will have the good address.
Now, all these are different concepts, but there's a common thread running through all of this, which is your emphasis on flexibility and hospitality.
Exactly.
Can you talk about that?
We always care about being next to the client. So I'm always, me or Olivier are always nearby the client and checking what the client need. It's not about only food. You will have to get the food. You will have to get the service. You will have to get the after food. That's something I do a lot, is going out with clients if they want to go out, giving them places to go. Even sometimes if they have an addict, it's not the first time I go to the pharmacy. So we take care of the clients as if they were my friends in my house.
Wow.
So that's something... it's difficult to find in other places.
But what about the food? Because you come from a family of chefs.
Yes,
so
exactly.
So tell us something about your food.
So our food is going to be, not this fancy food that you see with all, as I said, say to clients, sometimes people say, how is your food? My food doesn't have any flowers, all this mousse or whatever. My food is food with good ingredients, fresh ingredients, and it's an easy food. So you can even do it at your house, but people love it because it's old food. It's
traditional.
Traditional. I can tell you one story that stays with me. When like maybe 3 years ago, I had a client, an American client, who was about 60 years old, or more.
Oh, an old person like me.
No, he was already old, and he had a tomato soup that we served here, and on the set menu, he got the soup, and I went to the table as I always do, because I always go and ask if everything was okay, and he looked at me, and I saw his eyes he was crying a little bit.
What?
You know, tears in his eyes.
Oh dear.
And I said, "What's happening?" And he said, "Natalie, your soup remembered me, my grandmother." So that was something that I got. That's how I can describe maybe my food. It's something that you have. It was an American client, and that was funny.
It was his.
Brought memories of more than 100 years. I don't know, because it was his grandmother, so that was funny.
Your family has French roots, French influence.
We are not French. The funny thing is that we are Portuguese. My grandmother is Portuguese. My grandfather is Portuguese. But when they were babies, they were going to Brazil. Apparently there was a storm in the boat of my grandmother. The mother of my grandmother said, no, this is God's destiny. And they went to Morocco. And Morocco was a
French colony.
So my grandmother met my grandfather over there because she was 6 months and he was 7 years old when they arrived to Morocco. So they met there as Portuguese and they got married. They got kids, 3 boys, one of them my father. So they always had a French education, French talking, my father. And then there was the revolution over there. And my father and my grandmother, the only country they could come was Portugal. So when they arrived to Portugal, they didn't even know how to speak Portuguese. My father speaks not so well Portuguese.
Now
he speaks well. But anyway, so.
Actually, he was one of the first TV chefs in Portugal, right?
Exactly, the first one.
He was probably successful because he sounded a little bit like a male version of Julia Child.
Yes, exactly, because he couldn't speak Portuguese. Exactly like that. That was funny.
So what do we expect we're going to do?
I was going to mention that, Natalie, that Olivier has an interesting dining concept. Because everybody starts with the same thing.
The first thing is good success, I think when you go out, the people don't like to see the menu. So the good thing here, you arrive and you eat whatever I give you. And we always work with the set menu. So that was the big success of Olivier. And the set menu has 9 years now. And that's how we start to be known in all the world. Nowadays, everybody knows us. So you arrive and you have 9 starters, sorbet, and a main course. That's how we always work. At this restaurant now, we have the 2 options of having or the set menu, so all these 9 starters, which are totally surprised, and I don't even like to say which they are when the client arrives, or you can just do 5 starters because we couldn't give a list of starters. We can't work with lists. It's too hard. So we give 5 starters to the client, and then he can choose a fish or a meat on the menu. But if you do a la carte, you don't choose. We bring you. Each dish is a different dish. Portuguese, French, Moroccan.
How about American? You've got apple pie with vanilla ice cream.
We always have, yes, we have something. We have Americans love the scallops, so the scallops are...
Okay, can we cheat just a little bit for tonight, because we're recording before dinner? Can you just mention a couple of things that might be among those 9 surprises?
So today you will have, I think, because we're always changing, but today we're going to have like something we never take out of the menu because it has already this 9 years and I can't take it off because clients come and they want to have it. So we always have fresh foie gras with onion confits and port wine. We always have a crab guacamole. Then we have a puff pastry with goat cheese, honey and nuts. And that's all the things that we always keep then. And one of the big success here in Portugal is there's no translation. So the dish is called alheira, which is a Portuguese dish. It's a game sausage. And this is a sausage that was created by the Jewish when the Inquisition was going after them. They create a sausage because the Portuguese eat a lot of sausage with pork. And they create sausage okay. made with bread and chicken, garlic and vinegar.
And they
hanged on their doors, so that could seem like the chorizo. And so that's a sausage called alheira. And normally it's made with chicken. Here at the restaurant, we have it with game. So we have, it's going to
wonderful.
Be more raffiné and comes with a small quail egg. And that's a really, the Portuguese love it because it's really traditional. The tourists, some like it, some don't like it because it's a different taste. So that's something you have to try it, and then you can say, record if you like it or not.
Well, you know, this sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, I think just meeting you makes us excited about what we're going to have for the meal. And that's the whole point of Olivier, right?
Exactly. That's what you're going to have. You don't need to know what you're going to eat. And there was another funny story at the restaurant. There's always funny stories because I speak so much with the client. There was a client, as soon as he arrived to the restaurant, he said, "Oh, I don't like set menus because I don't like anything." And I said, "Look, do you like my eyes?" And he looked at me and he said, "Yes, you have lovely eyes." And I said, "Okay, so for my eyes, what we're going to do now is I'm not going to tell you anything I put on the table. I only tell you what you eat after you eat it." And he got everything, and he said he didn't like avocado, and he had guacamole. He said he didn't like octopus. He had octopus. He had everything, and he ate everything. And that's something that that's a game for me.
That's cool.
It sounds like you won that game.
Yeah. I win that game.
Well, listeners, I mean, you can't see her, but she's a very lovely woman. And I can
understand how
you could play with those eyes.
Thank you.
And keep us posted about the new projects as they're coming along, so that we know in advance that they're coming, so that we can announce it on OTM News. And who knows? This is our first time in Lisbon, but I'm already getting the feeling that somehow that we might be back.
Yeah. Obrigada.
De nada.
Merci bien.
But if you get here before us, Natalie and Olivier will take care of you, whichever the location you're at.
Of course.
Thank you so much for taking
Thank
the time
you
to talk to us.
Very much.
And now we've been stopping the guests having music, so now it's
yes,
time
exactly.
to turn the music on.
I have
on.
To put a little bit of music and start to giving you some food too.
Thank you so much, Natalie.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you are, listeners. 2 weeks programs devoted to our visit to the city of Lisbon. It was our first visit. It certainly won't be our last. Well, there you are, listeners. 2 weeks programs devoted to our visit to the city of Lisbon. It was our first visit. It certainly won't be our last. So we thought we'd bring you a special bonus at the end of the program. So after we say goodbye, if you're interested in 22 minutes on the new Portuguese table by David Leet, you'll get a lot of background information about this interesting little European country. And we'll say goodbye in the meantime. So until the same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye. Well, I was very excited to find out that there is the new Portuguese table available, because I am an admirer from afar, unfortunately, of Portuguese cuisine. And we have the author David Leet on the phone talking to us. David, welcome to On the Menu.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Now, let's get right to the heart of the matter, is that what used to be said about Portuguese food, that it consisted of, 352 recipes for cod.
Right. It's said that the Portuguese have 365 recipes for cod, and or
365. That shows
right, or 1,000 recipes for cod, depending who you talk to.
Oh, okay. Anyhow, actually, that was from my chef friend.
Uh-huh.
But you proved just the opposite. Tell us what is this book? You said it's like a 3-pronged approach to the Portuguese table. Could you explain it?
I'd be happy to. I come from a Portuguese family in America, and when I wanted to understand more about Portuguese cuisine, I went to Portugal many, many times, and I lived there for the better part of 2007, and when I was studying and researching, speaking to chefs and home cooks, what I noticed was there were different dishes that were arising. There were all these brand new dishes that I had never heard of before, and people were taking a lighter hand to some of the classics, which doesn't mean it's like Portuguese food light. It's just that they're doing things slightly different. They're adding a little bit of different herbs. They're not so heavy with olive oils.
Why is that so pronounced in Portugal? I mean, you can find it in Italy, but you still, as I was just saying to Peter, you still have places where there is nothing but traditional Italian regional cooking. So why has this modern movement hit Portugal so much?
I think that there's part of it has to do with the fact that Spain took off.
That's true.
And it became huge. And, of course, that's just across the border. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the Portuguese go to what's called the congressos, or the congresses, or the conventions in Spain quite often. They come back. They're fueled by ideas. They're fueled by new technologies. They're fueled by and inspired by what they saw and what they experienced and what they tasted. And they brought it back to their own cuisine. And then, secondly, I also think that in the last 20 or 30 years, they no longer were under a dictatorship with Salazar. A lot of these chefs, especially the younger chefs now, I've spoken to many who came to America. One went actually to Pittsburgh to study. Enrique Sapasoa was in Pittsburgh. And he studied in Pittsburgh, I believe, and there were some that studied in New York, some in Australia, and in the Far East, and some in London, and they came back, and they brought what they learned and turned it to their own ingredients, to their own culture. And they didn't obscure their cuisine. They just enlivened it and enriched it with what was there. And so I think that has a lot to do with why things are kind of burbling along. Of course, you can go to the countryside and get true, true classic Portuguese cuisine, which has been there for centuries.
But you said you had an epiphany almost when you were, at one point you were there, you said that at least where you seem to be eating, the old Portuguese food that you knew had disappeared. The Portugal you knew about had gone, but then I guess you found it again as well.
I did. When I was sitting at a wonderful meal at my friend José Vilela's house, he had all these people who were major foodies, and they are, in a sense, no different than the foodies and the food fanatics and the culinistas that I know here in America. And they were, as I talk about, they were talking about the need for sous vide machines at home and what their different favorite rices were and whether this chef is better or that chef's better. And he served a dish, which is partridge escabeche. And traditionally, it's equal parts oil, equal parts vinegar, and you just let it simmer for a very long time till it's falling off the bone. He added wine, he added spices, he added a lot of garlic, he added pearl onions, all these different things that he added that gave it kind of a much more invigorated flavor, but it was still very true to the dish. And that's when I realized, I talk about having this crowbar pop, a realization, as something inside popped, where I realized that the old ways are still there, but this is what's really exciting to me. And I talk about how even though the pantry has changed since my father came to America in 1958 and the culture has changed, it doesn't mean that I'm being any less inauthentic or the food is any less inauthentic by me pursuing some of this more modern stuff. So then I went on a dual track of chasing the classics and chasing the modern dishes. And it was really an exciting journey for me because I learned so incredibly much when I was there.
Oh, it reads like you had a wonderful time. I mean, I just wanted a book. Tickets to go.
Yeah, like, I'm ready too.
Like leaving tomorrow, you make it sound so exciting. Because I like the sound of some of the traditional stuff too. There's some kind of soup or stew that comes from near Portugal, from near Porto, that has a list of ingredients.
Is that where Tony's from?
Includes tripe and chicken.
Oh, yes, that's the tripe Porto style, which has got the chicken and the pork and practically every part of the pork, from the snout to the tail, and beans, and it's quite a lovely, hearty dish. And there's also a tradition or a legend behind that, which is when some of the navigators were leaving from Porto and they were going to do some of the discoveries, that they gave the best parts to the sailors. And what was left over were the scraps, like the snouts and the ears and the pig's tails and the hocks. And that's what the people back in Porto used to make their own stew.
Oh, yeah. I see. Okay.
And so, it's called tripish, which means tripe. And
when Vasco da Gama set off.
Exactly. So that was some of the legend behind that. I don't know if it's historically true, but it's certainly a beautiful romantic legend of the dish.
Now, somebody introduced this to the name extreme parts of the animal, the offal and so on, calling it the fifth quarter.
Oh, interesting.
And is that a French term, isn't it? No?
I don't know.
I think, I anglicized it into the fifth quarter, but if you cut a cow or a pig into four parts, then surely you've only got four quarters, but this one is the fifth.
This is the fifth.
And somebody christened, added in a book that we came across. My own introduction to Portuguese cooking, I mean, never having been in Portugal, is we have a friend here, Tony Pies, who who cooks in a Portuguese way, and I knew I was onto something different the first time we had pork and clams in the same pot.
It's an unusual combination. Yeah.
So you get ready for some interestingly different combinations.
And a cataplana, which I've always wanted one of those. They're so pretty.
Aren't they beautiful?
Yeah.
Yeah, I brought back a few copper ones, different sizes. Uh-huh. They're just marvelous.
What are these bread things with little eyes?
The bread things with what, I'm sorry?
With little eyes and mouth. Is it fish?
Oh, yes. That's a photograph that I took actually during a terrible, terrible downpour during the All Saints Festival. And that's when the sardine festival begins, or the sardine season begins. And if you've ever had truly fat, marvelous Portuguese sardines, which are very hard to find here in America, they're a revelation, because we think of sardines, those small little skinny fish that are in cans.
Now, we used to have an annual sardine party that Tony helped cook for, and there's another Portuguese chef who has a Spanish restaurant, and they used to drive to New Jersey and get the sardines.
Now, when the Sardinia were in, they would take a cooler up to somewhere in New Jersey and buy a case full and bring it back, and then there would be a party.
I'm sure they went to Newark, because Newark in the Ironbound section is the big Portuguese section and Spanish section. And so those breads actually were from a bakery, and they have little raisin, olive eyes.
Oh, they're so cute.
They shape them to look like sardines, and they're sold during the beginning of the festival, and it's an amazing time in Portugal.
Now, you said you took photographs. These photographs are wonderful. You have your Nuno Correa.
Nuno Correa, yes. Correa. Nuno did all of the major food shots throughout the cookbook. Anything that has to do with the countryside or any of the chapter openers, like the fish there, or there's a beautiful picture of the sea with fishermen, all of those are my photographs.
Well, I bet you're very proud of them. Now, let's give people an introduction to Portugal geographically and take the food along with it.
Okay.
It's a very small country.
Very. Size of Indiana.
It's known historically, curiously enough, as England's oldest ally.
Yes.
I am English, and so we remember that.
Okay.
The other thing I remember is that when I was studying geography at the University of Cambridge, we were all very proud of Salazar, the then dictator, because he was the professor of geography at Lisbon University before he was president.
Oh, there you go.
And they said, our teachers, some of whom had actually studied under him, said, he was really a most reluctant president.
Well, interesting. Well, I know that my family has quite a different recollection
of I'm sure
Salazar.
So does Tony. And
we got a slightly different introduction to it.
But, of course.
But as a small country, nevertheless, there's a huge range between the part of Portugal that's associated with making port, and then there are all kinds of mountain sections, and then there are all these islands, and it's from those islands that you yourself come.
Yes,
so can you? I think listeners will be fascinated if you just step us through those and contrast them by what's in their cuisine, what's in their cooking pot.
I'd be happy to. There are 11 major historical regions. They no longer use them. They've broken down the country into different communities and different governmental municipalities. But there are 11 major historical regions that, for instance, my father grew up learning, as we grew up learning our states. And from the north to the south, and then also the islands of Madeira, it's vastly different. So starting in the north, you have the Minho, which is in the northwest. It's very green. It's somewhat mountainous, but very green, very rich, very lush. That's where Vinho Verde comes from, which is what's called green wine. And people say, well, it's green wine because it's a green area. Not so much. Some say it's because it's a green area. Some say it's because it's picked young. But it is a young, brash, sort of somewhat effervescent wine. It can kind of slap you a little bit because it's so fresh and so young and served really nicely cool. But they've done some things where instead of serving it as soon as it's ready to be served, they're now bottling it and keeping it for a year or two, which different things are happening to it. And then up there you have one of the classic dishes of all time, which is called caldo verde, which is green soup, which I think is appropriate for the Emerald Province. And that is potatoes and onions that have been sautéed. Traditionally, it's just water added, and then you finely chop the kale, cove galega, or Galician kale, into whisker-thin slices. You add them, and you have one slice of chorizo, which is our famous sausage, one of our famous sausages, and then you drizzle some nice fresh green olive oil on top. That's up there, too. And you also get some of the codfish dishes up there in that region, too. But that's really one of the things that comes to mind as kind of an iconic dish in that region. Then moving to the east is Trajumonch and also the Alto Douro. Now, that is really, Trajumonch means beyond the mountain. So it's a very barren area, and it's kind of rough land. And the Alto Douro is the high Douro. Now, the Douro is the river that flows all the way down to Porto. And that's where the famous, famous port wine comes from, where the grapes come from. And in those regions, you're having everything is very, very meaty. And pork is king up there, as it is in all of Portugal. And presunto, which is the smoked hams, come up from up there, especially the towns of Chaves and Lamego. And then you also have some of the interesting desserts called tocinho de seio. Tocinho de seio means bacon from heaven. Now, there's no bacon in it whatsoever, but they believe that where it came from was that lard was used in it, and also bits of smoked ham was originally used in the dish. And that's one of these sort of unusual dishes from that region, as well as you get a lot of chestnut dishes, roasted chestnuts, chestnut purees, chestnut cakes come up from there also. And then moving down, you start going into what's called the Beta Sisters. The Beta Sisters are Beta Litoral, Beta Baixa, and Beta Alta. And that sort of cuts a swath above the meridian, let's say, of the country. And it goes from the left, which is the seacoast, all the way up to the mountains. And again, the food changes dramatically. Of course, at the coast, you have incredible seafood. And then the higher up you go, it relies more upon goats, upon sheep, mutton, lamb. And you have one of the most famous cheeses from that region on the high mountains is queijo de serra, which is a marvelous soft cheese that what you do is you shear the top of the cheeses off and you can dip in with a spoon. It's so unctuous.
That sounds like our kind of cheese.
It's absolutely a marvelous, marvelous cheese, and it's all handmade, and only 6 or 7 can be made per day. It just takes that long to do.
Mm.
And it's a marvelous, marvelous cheese, one of my favorite cheeses. And then, of course, you get down to where Lisbon is, which is the center of the capital of the country, and that is the Extremadura region, which has got tremendous amounts of coastline and very seafood-oriented, lots of seafood dishes. A sorda is like a bread soup, and a sorda de marisco is a seafood bread soup, and it's one of the most exquisite dishes that I've ever had. There's also a famous restaurant in Lisbon called Papa Sorda, because it does have a sort of pap quality to it. It's very soft, and it's got shrimp, and it can have scallops, and it can have clams and mussels, and it's just amazing what they have there. And then going down below that is the east of that is the Ribatejo, which is known for their horses. They're very famous horses.
Oh, and do they eat horse meat?
You know what? Some of them do, but I do. I never came across it. I think that may have been something that I just decided to avoid.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's not really my favorites. I never saw it on a menu.
We saw it in Sardinia. They listed it as Grand Prix.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. And then you have below that, you have two major regions. One of them is called the Algarve, which is all the way to the south, which is the coastal region.
Mm-hmm.
It's very built up. A lot of travelers, a lot of tourists are there. But you can get way far east and way far west, you can get some nooks and crannies that still are very old Portugal. And you also have, just above that, you have the very famous Alentejo, the upper and the lower Alentejo, which is all desert. So basically, you start at the top, which is very green, and you go down to these big mountainous regions, which bisect the country in half. And below that is very deserty. And Salazar decided that was going to be the breadbasket, so brought in a lot of irrigation, and that's where a lot of grain is now. But it's still very, very hot in the summer. And that's where a lot of the forage dishes come from, because there was absolutely nothing to eat. So a lot of the peasants would go and forage. And when I was staying with someone, she was making me purslane soup. And she walked out the door, she came back about 20 minutes later, said, "Where'd you go?" She said, "I was pulling purslane up from the inside the between the cracks in the sidewalk.
Yeah, well, this we have a running bat on our household because I love parsley and Vita won't eat it.
Yeah. Interesting.
She likes putting weeds in my salad. Sticks and weeds.
It's from our garden. What could be wrong with it?
Exactly, and that's what she did. She just pulled it up from any place that was growing between cracks in the sidewalk and then on the side of the hill and made this incredible soup that had purslane, had potatoes, had hollowed out shells of cheese and bits of cheese in there, and it was just marvelous.
Now, you do outline this in the introduction to your book so that if the listeners haven't been taking notes, they can find it in the book.
And it goes into more detail of the dishes to have when you're in those regions.
Yeah, you say where to go, what to eat, what to drink.
Exactly.
Okay, and then you've got a few islands just to complete the country out, right?
Yes, there's the Madeira, which, of course, being British, Peter, you would know, is very much an important place for production of Madeira. It's where Madeira comes from.
Yes.
And it's an incredibly beautiful island. It's subtropical, so you've got these beautiful waterfalls, and the north side of the island is impossibly green. And then you have the Nine Azores Islands, which is what I'm very familiar with, where my family came from. They are volcanic islands and subtropical and, again, impossibly green. And that's where you get some of the best beef in all of Portugal, because they were brought over supposedly by the Dutch. And cows and the beef are just incredible. They're certified beef, the DOP beef. And the cheeses are lovely there. People are very friendly and very warm. And you're in the middle of the island, the middle of the ocean. You're 1,000 miles off the coast of Portugal. And imagine Hawaii, my guess is like 50 or 60, 70 years ago. And
so they're that far away. Wow.
They're 1,000 miles. That's the middle island. You can get even farther away when you go all the way to the west.
What about the Canary Islands? Aren't they owned by Portugal?
No,
well?
They're
not
Spain,
owned by Portugal.
Oh, they're
yes,
Spain.
They're not
Spain.
Portugal.
Okay. They're in the same general area, but
they're south and they're west of Madeira.
This one of your most famous dishes is anything with piri piri.
Yes,
and you say it packs a gut punch of heat. That's putting it mildly.
Yes, it's true. It's interesting. I just did an article for the Chicago Tribune about piri piri, and I learned even more than I did when I was writing the book. Those companies that import from South Africa, which is where the piri piri comes from, the more the particular fruit is stressed, meaning that there's not water, there's too much sun, the hotter it gets. And that's what makes the really, really hot piri piri. And then the ones that are grown in Portugal are not as hot because they're not as stressed. The conditions are a little bit not as extreme, but they're still an amazing sauce, and people make it lots of different ways. Sometimes they just whip it up with olive oil, and that's what they use. Sometimes they put in vinegar. I have a recipe, two different recipes, one for a paste and one for a sauce. The paste uses whiskey and garlic and lemon zest and lemons and all kinds of ginger and all kinds of flavors that I found when I was there. And you rub it on, and then you grill, and it's absolutely marvelous.
You really are enthusiastic. No wonder you wrote such a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you.
And David, you grew up in the same place that Emeril Lagasse.
Emeril Lagasse did.
Did you know him?
I met him on his show. He did a show on Fall River, Massachusetts, and I was sitting with his father and his mother. So we met and said hello, and he spoke to me a little bit on camera, but I wasn't a cooking guest. But I didn't know him growing up, although we're about the same age, but I did not know him growing up.
Was it that large a community?
It's very, very large. It's pretty much the largest Portuguese community in America. I call it the biggest little Portugal in America because it encompasses a huge part of Rhode Island, all of southeast New England and part of the Cape, and even goes all the way up to Boston because my father's family lives in Somerville in Cambridge. And there's a big Portuguese community up there also. So.
Yeah, I remember historically the first Portuguese who went there were whalers, were they not?
They were. They went to New Bedford. As a matter of fact, if you read Moby Dick, if I'm not mistaken, it's been a while now, there is a character in the very beginning when it starts out in New Bedford, and he's called the Portuguese.
Okay. Yes, indeed.
If I'm not mistaken.
Indeed there is.
And they came for whaling, and that's why they settled. And a lot of the women, including my aunts, were very good at sewing and lace making, and
oh,
they
wow.
were hired by the textile industry, which was big in New England.
Sure, right. Yeah.
But your father came over much more recently. And
my father came in 1959, and my mother's family came over in about 1920.
Okay.
You know, some of the transmigrations are so fascinating. When we were doing research in the Basque region, we found out that one of the largest communities of Basques outside of Spain is in Utah.
Oh, interesting.
There's another group in San Francisco.
Is
the one in Utah?
Utah is big.
but there's a very large group in San Francisco as well.
Well, this is an important book, David, because the Portuguese table has influenced, because they're seafaring people.
Okay.
Well, David, I would hardly recommend this book to anybody, everybody, because the new Portuguese table is, well, just Portuguese anyhow, is a cuisine that's affected so many countries, so many places, from the Far East to South America, because the Portuguese were seafaring. So I guess that enriches the native cuisine, but it also enriches all the cuisines of all the other countries. And I for one, am thrilled to bits with this book. It's moving us to get our act in gear here and go to Portugal.
How marvelous.
Yeah. So thank you for taking time to talk to us.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
And let me know what you're doing next.
I sure will.
Okay, David. Thank you so much.
Bye, Peter. Thank you, Ann.
Bye.